Good evening, and a welcome also to KCPW listeners. This is the 22nd annual Sterling McMurrin Lecture on Religion and Culture. My name is Bob Goldberg. I'm a professor of history and also the director of the Tanner Humanities Center at the University of Utah. Please take a moment to silence your cell phones, your pagers, and all things that might beep in the night. Sterling McMurrin died in 1996. He left a profound legacy of scholarship and service. Professor McMurrin taught in both the departments of history and philosophy. He served the university as Dean of the College of Letters and Science, Dean of the Graduate School, Academic Vice President, and Provost. In his name, the McMurrin Lectures on Religion and Culture were established. Their goal is to provide the best scholarship on religion to our students, faculty, and the Utah community. Please note that tonight's lecture, a part of the U's Mormon Studies Initiative, is the keynote address for the conference, Women and the LDS Church, Historical and Contemporary Perspectives. The conference begins at 9 a.m. tomorrow and will be held at the Fort Douglas Officers Club. All events are free and open to the public. I would like now to introduce Kate Holbrook, PhD candidate at Boston University and specialist in women's history at the LDS Church History Department. Kate will introduce this year's McMurrin Lecturer.
Because we want to hear from Professor Ulrich this evening, I will not be able to list all of her honors and awards in their entirety, but I do want to give you some highlights. Since 2006, she has held the distinguished post of University Professor at Harvard University. University professorships are chairs intended for individuals of distinction, working on the frontiers of knowledge and in such a way as to cross the conventional boundaries of the specialties. Her second book, A Midwife's Tale, is one of the most highly regarded works written about early American history. A Midwife's Tale won both the Pulitzer Prize for History and the Bancroft Prize in American History in 1991, plus 8 other awards. Professor Ulrich served as president of the American Historical Association in 2009, is a fellow for both the American Philosophical Society and the American Academy for Arts and Sciences, and has received numerous other awards and honors, including teaching and mentoring awards for her work with students at Harvard. She received a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1991 and a MacArthur Fellowship in 1992, as well as other fellowships. She serves on many boards and often consults for numerous American historical societies and museums. Most of you here tonight know that Professor Ulrich is famous, but I want to make sure you also understand why her work has been so abundantly decorated. First, she conceives and models groundbreaking methodologies for the study of history. She uncovers historical understandings that include the thought and experience of women and of regular people. She discovers lives that are otherwise unrecorded. As former Harvard President Larry Summers said, she has vividly illuminated the history of colonial America and the early republic through the imaginative and painstaking exploration of ordinary lives. Professor Ulrich says her work endeavors to show the interconnection between public events and private experience. In books like The Age of Homespun, A Midwife's Tale, and Good Wives, she examines and illustrates the significance of women's labors. These books help us to see how women have exercised agency and shaped communities during their respective periods. For example, Ulrich herself wrote, "Some history making is intentional. Much of it is accidental. People make history when they scale a mountain, ignite a bomb, or refuse to move to the back of the bus. But they also make history by keeping diaries, writing letters, or embroidering initials on linen sheets. History is a conversation and sometimes a shouting match between present and past, though often the voices we most want to hear are barely audible. People make history by passing on gossip, saving old records, and by naming rivers, mountains, and children. Some people leave only their bones, though bones too make a history when someone notices. In Well-Behaved Women Seldom Make History, she writes about how history has been written, how women's history has been written, and how these approaches have shaped, sometimes in defective ways, our current understandings about the world and about women. In a Slate magazine article, Megan Marshall reports that Professor Ulrich has expanded the scope and texture of the history field while deepening its rigor at the same time. Professor Ulrich reveals misleading arguments and straw men. Her work is accurate, meticulously researched, and consummately responsible. The title of her current book, Under Contract with Knopf, is A House Full of Females, Faith and Kinship in 19th Century Mormon Diaries. Both her work and her person urge us to tell more complete and meaningful histories. Please join me in welcoming Professor Laurel Ulrich to the podium.
Thank you. Thanks, Kate. Boy, you really did your homework. I can't remember, though, did you say I was a graduate of the University of Utah? And I'm very proud of that. I'm proud of being a graduate of a university that was coeducational from the beginning, about a century before the institution where I teach now. And I really got my foundation at the U. Didn't ever study with Professor McMurrin. I knew him by reputation. I read some of his work. But it was a wonderful era in the 1950s when I was there, have to admit. I graduated in 1960, which is a long time ago. I'm taking the title of my talk this evening from a schoolgirl sampler made in colonial America. It has tiny little stitches done by a 9-year-old girl who portrays a whimsical Adam and Eve sort of joining hands around an apple in front of a tree. And there are whimsical animals around them. And then she embroidered in meticulous and tiny stitches two verses. The first one identified her, gave her a name and a location. Sarah Silsby is my name. I belong to the English nation. Boston is my dwelling place, and Christ is my salvation. Then she shifted modes, and the second little verse reads, when I am dead and laid in grave, and all my bones are rotten, when this you see, remember me, and never let me be forgotten. Well, when I first read this second verse, I wanted to attribute it to a Puritan tendency to frighten children. And I thought of grim sermons in unheeded churches and images of skulls carved onto gravestones. Then my husband and I decided to remodel the upstairs of our New Hampshire house. And as we tore out the rough sawn pine paneling in one of the rooms, we found little notes, acorns, coins, tiny toys that our children had dropped through the knot holes 20 years before. With a blue felt-tipped pen, our daughter Melinda provided her name, a little history of her own dwelling place, and then she concluded, "I am 9 years old, but when you find this early history, I'll probably be dead. Like the young embroiderer, and at the very same age, my daughter was learning to place herself in time as well as in space. And it seems to me that that desire to leave some mark behind when you are no longer there is part of the essence of what it means to be a human being. But that impulse has taken different forms over time. The words "remember me" have a long and very intriguing history. In the Bible, they were often uttered in prayer, so that when Job, David, Samson, Hannah, and the thief on the cross said, "Remember me," they were seeking divine favor. It was a hierarchical relationship. But in the early modern world, in the period where I've done a lot of my own research, was very different. Ordinary people began to use those same words not to make a claim on God, but on each other. And the exact verse that I found on Sarah Silsby's embroidery shows up at all kinds of places. And the words "remember me" and some form of versification show up on powder horns, on school books, on scrimshaw, in folk songs, children's ring games, and in many, many, many samplers. They also continue into the 19th century, and they show up in some of the same places and often in autograph albums, as in one from the 19th century Ozarks. "Remember me early, remember me late, remember me as your old schoolmate." That would probably work on Facebook today. So this evening, I want to explore some of the ways in which 19th century Mormons asked to be remembered. I'm interested in the topic because I'm just interested in it, so I want to explore it for its own sake. But I'm also interested in it for what it can tell us about the difficulties and the possibilities of writing women's history. In keeping with my assigned topic, I've been thinking about agency and the relationship between agency and women's history in the past and in contemporary times as well. And we think of agency as sort of self-willed action. You recognize that agency really begins with an ability to identify yourself as a distinct person. I am Sarah Silsby, or I am Melinda Ulrich, and to make some kind of claim on the world, if not on historical records. I'm also interested in the claims that early 19th century Mormons made on us. These were probably unintentional claims, but as I think everybody in this room knows, without source material, there is no history. And as people begin to make claims on others, even if it's only "remember me, my good friend," they leave a document that then can become raw material for historians trying to recapture the past. So even though I'm going to be focusing on the 19th century Mormonism, because that's what I've been studying, I'm also going to be talking about us and about the claims that the past makes on us. So I'm going to take us on a little romp through the archives and try to introduce you to some of the sources that I found exciting to work with among Latter-day Saints, some of the difficulties, and the range of materials. So toward the end of my talk, I'm going to come back to samplers and autograph books and some of those more seemingly ephemeral documents. But I want to begin by thinking about diaries and letters and autobiographies and minute books, things that are more conventionally used by historians. And I want to make a couple of points. First of all, I want to suggest that as historians and as amateur historians, as family members interested in the 19th century past, we need to be more attentive than I think we have been to the circumstances in which documents were created. We also need to be more attentive to the ways that in our own behavior we replicate some of the biases that have made it difficult to recapture women's history. So here we go with a little bit of romp through the archives. I want to start by pointing out something that surprised me as I began my project. I had an idea because of the absolutely path-breaking and fabulous work done in the 80s and 90s by some of you in this room in editing women's diaries and in beginning the work of writing 19th century Mormon women's history. I had the idea that Mormons might be a little bit exempt from the general pattern of women not producing a lot of documents. And I soon found out that that was not so. So let me begin with a very straightforward point, that there are actually very few Mormon women's diaries. Do you believe that? When you see the wonderful materials that have been published by Utah State University and other places, they're actually fewer than you might think. Now, there are a lot of reasons for this, but the basic reason is there are an awful lot of men's diaries. So proportionally, it may be 10 to 1, 20 to 1, 100 to 1, I'm not sure. But men's diaries just way outweigh anything that women wrote. The old notion that women are the ones who keep diaries is false, at least for this population. And why is that? The reason is obvious. For men, diary keeping was a church responsibility. How many of you in this audience have a missionary diary in your family, in your household? I think we have four in our household. Only one diarist, my husband's great-great-grandfather, actually kept writing his diary after he got home from his mission. But there are all those diaries kept by men. In a recent, a wonderful digital collection done by Brigham Young University Library of 114 diarists, missionary diarists, there are five women. And those 114 diaries were selected from a vast number of other possibilities, mostly male. So the ratios are really quite startling. When Wilford Woodruff was called on a mission in 1833, he began keeping a diary. He was unusual only in that he kept going. In the 1850s, he was meeting with a group of elders, and he said, I have kept a journal of almost every day of my life for the last 24 years. I could tell each day what I had done, what company I was in, and what was transpiring around me. You may say that this is a great deal of trouble. Very well. It has been to me in one sense. But what of it? I have never spent any of my time more profitably for the benefit of mankind than in my journal writing. Interestingly, when he began that first missionary diary, he wrote at the top, "The First Book of Wilford." he got the point. Whatever the elders said when moved upon by the Holy Ghost was Scripture. Well, consider how the history of the church might look. If female converts had been given a journal at the moment of baptism and told to keep an account of their own spiritual experiences and their activity in the church, if that had happened, we would not only have Woodruff's record of holding a meeting at Polly Vose's house in Boston on the backside of Beacon Hill in 1838, but we might know what people said there, and we might understand who was there, the church members that Woodruff identified only as the sisters. Think, too, about how Mormon history would look if the wives of missionaries had been called to keep journals while their husbands were away. That sometimes happened. At her husband's request, Mary Richards kept a journal while her husband Samuel was serving in England. And her account of the difficult crossing from Nauvoo and her life at winter quarters until he returned are some of the most powerful and revealing documents from that period, and wonderfully edited by Maureen Ward and Utah State University Press. This is a rare example of what might have been. Diary keeping was a difficult task for anyone, as Woodruff himself admitted. But a belief that God or God's representative on earth wanted you to do it was a powerful incentive. Now, I don't believe it's accidental that the first women's diaries in the church, with the exception of one diary that was begun before the women joined the church and then quit, were actually begun after the founding of the Female Relief Society in Nauvoo. And those two diaries are short. They didn't last very long. One was kept by Eliza R. Snow at the time that she was beginning to keep the minutes of the Nauvoo Relief Society, and the other by Zinah Huntington Jacobs Smith Young, a much married woman. Now, why are there so few LDS women diaries? Many of them had left a little bit of education, not a lot of education. But if you think about it, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young were both barely literate. Yet they managed, and Heber Kimball, my goodness, yet they managed to fulfill this commandment of diary keeping initially and partly in their own hand, but then, of course, relying on scribes. But the issue is not just what was kept. The issue is what survived and what found its way into archives. So let's think for a minute about Eliza's and Zina's Nauvoo diaries. After Eliza's death, her diary passed from her brother Lorenzo to his daughter-in-law Elizabeth Wilson, who gave it to her home teacher in 1943 when he was helping to prepare her house for sale. He kind of rescued it. He saw a bonfire and said, hey, maybe this would be interesting to my wife. In 1965, the home teacher and his wife gave it to a couple in their neighborhood who had visited Nauvoo and become enthusiastic about church history. They then handed it over to the director of the Nauvoo Restoration, who eventually gave it to Bella Spafford, who was general president of the Relief Society, who had it conserved and then gave it to the church archives in a period, interestingly enough, when people were becoming very interested in women's history. We're talking about the late 20th century. Same thing with Zina. Wonderful account in Marty Bradley and Mary Woodford's book, The Four Zina. Zina's papers were kept in an old red tin bread box that she brought from Nauvoo, and Mary remembered seeing the bread box, but had sort of forgotten about it until she was looking for Christmas decorations in the basement of her mother's house, stumbled across it, opened it up. Other relatives found more of Zina's papers hidden behind the log walls. Think of, you know, those knot holes in our house. While they were restoring a house in Canada, and in 1980, a great-great-granddaughter found Zina's Nauvoo diary in a trunk that she had been using as a sofa table for 4 years without her ever opening it to see what was inside. What do you have in your houses? Scattered records left by the first generation of Mormon women tell us they wanted to be remembered. Recently, Connell O'Donovan shared with me a letter Augusta Adams Cobb wrote to Brigham Young. She had married him in polygamy and felt she was being neglected. She's a fabulous letter writer, and Connell will soon publish an edition of her letters, I think some 160 of them. Here's what she said to Brigham Young. "What I write, as a general thing, I feel is dictated by the Spirit of the Lord, as much so as when men get up in the stand and preach. And I hope and pray my words may long outlive me. What is not dictated by that Spirit, let it go into the land of forgetfulness, together with my weaknesses and follies, which I confess to be many, to be remembered no more forever." Well, Cobb certainly had weaknesses and follies, like all of us, but she had obviously been empowered by the belief that every Latter-day Saint was entitled to inspiration. And interestingly enough, she was probably one of those women who was in the house when Wilford Woodruff visited in 1838, one of the otherwise anonymous sisters. Thanks to her willingness to write and to save her letters, we now can know more about that early Boston branch. The very same year that Augusta Cobb wrote a letter to Brigham Young, Abigail Adam wrote one to the same man. This letter, this fabulous letter, appears in the brand new anthology that Brittany Chapman and Rick Turley have edited called Women of Faith. And one of my good friends, Kathy Halverson Hadfield, who is also a graduate of the University of Utah and now lives in Virginia, wrote that sketch about Abigail Adam Abbott and included this amazing letter. "To His Excellency Governor Brigham Young, Sir, I do not know, but I shall intrude upon your time and patience. If I do, I wish to be pardoned and will endeavor to be brief as possible in my remarks. Upon hearing of the celebration of our national independence and that it was designed for the soldiers that went in the Mormon battalion, and myself being companion of one of those men, I thought I would pen a few lines pertaining to what I experienced in that period of time." And then she goes on. You'll have to read the whole letter. It's just fabulous. Listing all the things she did while she was abandoned, first at Nauvoo and then at winter quarters when her husband went on with the Mormon battalion. I mean, she and another woman compact their combined 6 children into a wagon, walk partway across Iowa, spending most nights husking the 6 or 7 bushels of corn they had packed into the mouth of the wagon. I mean, she spun, she wove, she taught school, she built a house, she planted buckwheat and harvested it with a pole on a blanket. She crossed the Missouri River with 3 yoke of oxen, hauled 2 tons of hay, and in order to feed her family, gleaned turnips from other people's fields, giving every 3rd bushel she gathered. And then she continues, "I give this memoir of 3.5 years' travels only as a sketch. The rest is better realized than told. If it will be of any use or satisfaction to my brethren and sisters who were connected with the battalion or belonging to it, they are welcome to it for what it is worth. If it is not worth attention, please throw it under the table. But she wasn't through yet. On the celebration of national independence, when the battalion was going to march, she had a few other things she thought should happen. I would like an expression from Sister Eliza R. Snow, if there is no objection. And if the wives of those brethren that went in the battalion merit any applause or reward, I hope they will get it. No more at present, but remain your faithful sister in the bonds of the new and everlasting covenant. I'm especially interested in these two letters from 1852 because they contrast so remarkably with a speech given in Litchfield, Connecticut that same year by a man named Horace Bushnell, and I actually have written about this in my book, The Age of Homespun. But listen to what Bushnell says. It's a fabulous speech. He celebrates all the work of women and men in this purported age of homespun. But then he says something that epitomizes the attitude of many people in the 19th century and sadly some people today. Let no woman imagine that she is without consequence or motive to excellence because she is not conspicuous. Oh, it is the greatness of woman that she is so much like the great powers of nature. Behind the noise and clatter of the world's affairs, tempering all things with her benign influence, only the more certainly because of her silence. This is what I call being idealized into anonymity. Now let's think for a minute about letters. There are wonderful collections where you can get a sense of the immediacy of a period in exchanges between two people. They're often much more revealing than diaries. There are some examples of that. The Woodruffs, for example, at one point, almost equal numbers of letters, his to her and hers to his. But I haven't found many of those. More commonly, I found what I did when I was working up at Utah State University on the papers of an actual relative, William B. Preston, who married my great-grandfather's sister, Harriet Thatcher. And I found 100 letters from William to Harriet, for only 5 from Harriet to William. Now, why is that? Well, William was traveling, and Harriet saved his letters, and she didn't make copies of her own and save them. So you get this curious kind of one-sided correspondence. But as I thought about the two letters to Brigham Young, the one from Augusta Cobb and the one from Abigail Adam, it occurred to me there must be in the church archives, and some of you archivists here can tell me whether that's true or not, there must be hundreds of letters from women addressed to Brigham Young. Think of all those divorces, for example, that he had to answer. Wouldn't that be amazing? Years ago, Leonard Arrington edited a fascinating collection of Brigham Young's letters to his son. Wouldn't it be neat to have a collection of women's letters to Brigham Young? Somebody go do that. The problem is, I think a lot of those things are classified, and it wouldn't happen. But it should. Because the church is not only about the leaders, the church is about the individual members. Okay, another set of records, minute books. A lot of the material in the church archives is about official records of many kinds. Once the Relief Society was organized, there were minute books, and women began to keep those records, and they are really fabulous. I hope, most of you in this room know that the minutes of the Nauvoo Relief Society are online, and I understand there's going to be a wonderful new book coming out through the Joseph F. Papers that will include the Nauvoo minutes and biographies of all of the people listed there and additional documents from the Relief Society for its first 50 years. That's going to be exciting. This week I was reading some minutes from the 15th Ward Relief Society from 1870. And I just want to share a little snippet of the kind of thing you get. In the Nauvoo minutes, if you haven't read them, go read them, because you get real dynamic. You get discussion. People make motions, and they disagree, and they solve problems together. This is just a little snippet from Sally Russell, who was secretary of the 15th Ward Relief Society in July of 1870, after they had done the business of the day, which consisted of a lot of work they were doing, trying to take care of the poor. Sister Frances Chamberlain raised a question. When is a young lady qualified to marry? And the counselor in the Relief Society, Sister Jones, gave the answer. When she becomes a good housekeeper, can mend her husband's clothes, and the right person presents himself. So they continued. Question, to whom does a child owe its first loyalty? To its parents. After baptism, to God. Next question, to whom does a married lady owe her first duty? Question discussed, but not decided upon. Okay. I hope I've already made clear that institutions matter. The institutional support, regular patterns of record keeping are, you know, individuals can be inspired to keep records, but really, we all need nudges. And some of those nudges came from adversity, from conflict, from being attacked for your marital practices, from having the reorganized church deny that Joseph Smith had ever practiced polygamy. And so, ironically, most of what we know about plural marriage in its origins in Nauvoo in the 1840s comes from reminiscences and affidavits written from 20 to 40 years later. Now, those reminiscences are important, but they are shaped by the moment in which they are written. And I think we have not been as careful as we need to be, those of us who attempt to write Mormon history, in understanding that and in recognizing how little we really know about the Nauvoo period at the time, things written at the time. So I would like to urge us to be more attentive to the difference between a diary, a set of letters, minute books written in the heat of the moment, and retrospective accounts that come later. But those retrospective accounts are fabulous. And they really begin to come not just through controversy and not just through opposition to the church and not just about polygamy, but more broadly and more deeply for women after the reorganization of the Relief Society in the late 1860s and the founding of the Woman's Exponent in 1872. And if you will look at the life writings of women that you have in your families or that you may see in the published anthologies, I think you will see that that's true. There's an uptick in consciousness, in agency, in a desire to be remembered through the organization of the Relief Society and the engagement of Latter-day Saint women in the women's suffrage movement and in the larger movement for women's emancipation in the late 19th century. Now, many of the people who wrote were quite elderly, and they felt handicapped. I write this after I am 72 years old for my children to look at. It is wrote very poor. Perhaps you can't read it, Rhonda Siemens began. Sarah Levitt interrupted her narrative to explain, "My memory is so much impaired, it will be a jumbled up mess unless I have the spirit of truth to direct me." It was hard, but they persisted, because they felt God wanted them to do it. In July of 1887, a Parowan saint named Ruth Page Rogers wrote in her diary, "When I commenced to write, I'd done it for my own satisfaction and amusement, not thinking of writing to have it preserved for others, knowing I am a humble person. But the Lord has been mindful of me and blessed me in this life, and by the Spirit has whispered to me that I should have my writings preserved." I believe it was not only the Spirit of the Lord that whispered to her, but the demonstrable interest that other people had in what she had to say. That helps to explain why, finally, toward the end of her life, Jane James, an African-American woman whose story has been so wonderfully told recently in film and in print, began her autobiography and as told to story about her life, and that we'll soon learn a lot more about tomorrow if you come to the conference, from Quincy Newell. So the Exponent and the Relief Society, the Retrenchment Society, the other organizations of women made a huge difference. One of the things the Relief Society did in 1880, the anniversary of the church, the 50th anniversary of the founding of the church, was create jubilee boxes. And the idea was that people would write their histories, put them in the box, they would be sealed, and then they would be opened in 1930, the 100th anniversary of the church, and those documents would go to the oldest living female descendant of the woman who wrote it. Now, a few of these have survived in archives. I suspect that most of them are probably still in family hands, and I haven't been able to find a way to locate them or to examine them. But there's a project for somebody, a definable moment when a whole group of women under the organization of the Relief Society began to write these autobiographies. When Belinda Marden Pat read the Exponent account of the Jubilee, she wrote in her diary, "I could only give expression to my feelings in tears. What an age we are living in. How great the responsibilities of the sisters of the church. What a work they are accomplishing. And how many there are that do not realize the amount of work before them as helpers in this great dispensation." I think Belinda Marden Pratt is speaking to us. Not only to the professional historians in the room, but to anyone with an interest in ending the invisibility of Latter-day Saint women. We need to find what's in the walls of our houses. We need to raise money so that the work doesn't have to be done on a volunteer basis with people like Brittany Chapman, who works late at night after working all day in the church historical department. We need to ask for documents about women. We need to insist that our curriculum includes them. We also might find help and inspiration by considering less conventional documents. As I realized that there was an uneven production of diaries and letters in the book I'm writing is not going to use retrospective accounts except in the moment when they're written. And I've made that promise to myself. So I've had to innovate and look for other kinds of things in women's words. And one of the areas I turned to was autograph albums. And suddenly I discovered something interesting. A 1986 study of autograph albums in Utah archives found 65, half by women, half by men. Rather amazing. I mean, the ones by men were sometimes kept when they were in prison for polygamy. Now, they're really interesting. Some of the earliest autograph albums date from the Nauvoo period. One of the most fascinating was kept by a woman named Barbara Neff Moses, who was a Pennsylvanian, who came to Nauvoo and was greeted by everyone, and she did eventually join the church and go west. She started her autograph album in Nauvoo. She continued it to the end of the 19th century. She has signatures from lots of women, but also from Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor, Wilford Woodruff, Sidney Rigdon, W.W. Phelps, Orson Hyde, and of course Eliza R. Snow and Zina Young and others. I mean, one way to get into the church archives is to produce something that has a lot of church leaders' names in it. That often works. But these are really interesting. There is an autograph in Joseph Smith's handwriting in this album. Would you like to know what he wrote? I think we can all agree he was an amazing prophet and not a very good poet. So here's what he wrote. The truth and virtue both are good when rightly understood. But charity is better, miss. That takes us home to bliss. And so forthwith, remember Joseph Smith. I haven't yet found the Rotten Bones poem in LDS autograph albums, but that may be because I haven't looked hard enough. Because 19th century Mormons had no qualms about imagining death, and they'd had a lot of experience seeing loved ones die. More than once, Zina Huntington Young wrote in a friend's album, "Say, would it afford you a pleasing sensation, some trace of a friend to behold, when the heart that now dictates has ceased its pulsation, and the hand which now writes this is cold." In Zina's little verse, a heart isn't a valentine. It's a physical organ that pumps blood. And when its pulsation ceases, she knows from experience that a hand grows cold. But she also believes that the mark, the pen mark on the page made by that hand would remain. Today, I suppose DNA analysis gives credibility to the notion many 19th century Americans and Mormons had that by touching a piece of paper with their lips, they could actually send a kiss through the mail. John Taylor did it, Wilford Woodruff did it, other people did it. Zina called these physical manifestations of human action traces. In her world, an ink stroke or a twist of hair could actually invoke the presence of an absent loved one. And there's a lot of complex history about the way 19th century Americans used material objects. But the Mormons really imbibed that. I mean, you learn through your senses, and a physical artifact can help us recover some memory, some reality of what is lost. I think it helps us understand, in a way, things like baptism for the dead, you know, the vicarious, it's got to be done physically. The emphasis on ritual, the emphasis on ritual clothing, all of these things convey powerful and important spiritual meanings and connect one person to another. To the end of her life, Zina Huntington kept a little ornament made out of braided and woven hair that was inscribed with a poem on a piece of paper and had been given to her probably at Nauvoo, if not before. It was one of those things found in the lunchbox or in one of the other caches of documents that were almost lost. And it was made for her by her friend named Sophia Bull. And here's what this woman said in her little poem, which I'm sure wasn't original. I think it was something that was passed on, like the Rotten Bones poem. "Dear friend, except the lock of hair, which you so oft have seen me wear. I've worn it when in friendship's bower and passed with you the social hour. This little present kindly take, and keep it for the giver's sake. And when this lock of hair you see, my dear, dear friend, do remember me." So those locks of hair that seem so creepy to some archivists, when they find them. This afternoon, I looked at a lot of hair in the church museum. And one of the things that I looked at was so moving, I could not believe it. I had seen photographs, but I had no idea of the impact of this object. It was made in the 1880s by a woman from Manti named Mary Winch. She was the daughter of the bishop of the Manti South Ward, who was an immigrant from Denmark. And the Manti South Ward was the Scandinavian ward in Manti. And as they prepared for the dedication of the Manti Temple, Mary Winch collected hair from all of the sisters in the Relief Society. And she made this immense framed, it's a wreath, and then inside the wreath is a bouquet. And the bouquet in the photograph looks like it's in some kind of a gold-colored vase. But no. When you look very closely, you see that what is the vase that holds this is a representation of the baptismal font in the Manti Temple. And written across it are these words: "These locks of hair, O Lord, thou hast seen us wear. So now we commit them to thy holy temple's care." And beautifully it survived and is now in safe storage, occasionally on exhibit at the church museum. Now, these women understood the scripture, I think, in Matthew chapter 10, where Jesus said, that God was concerned for the very hairs of your head, and all are numbered. I mean, there's a kind of wonderful literal quality to this. And what's really amazing as you look at this fabulous artifact are the colors. All those blonde Scandinavians mixed in with the darker haired locks of hair. Well, I'm thrilled that Mary Winch made this artifact and that it ended up in the temple. It's even more exciting to me that she created a label. She or someone else created a label and put it on the object so that I was able to, you know, really confirm there was such a person and learn a little bit about her with a lot of help from other people. And as I saw this, I couldn't help but think about an experience I've had recently in my own area in Massachusetts. There's a woman in my stake who made an absolutely fabulous quilt. It's a representation of the first vision, but done in an impressionistic way. She didn't know how to do that kind of quilting, but she was determined that the church was going to be represented in an art show that was organized as a response to the attack on the September 11th attack. It was a kind of peacemaking gesture that women's groups all over the greater Boston area would come together and jointly create these beautiful works of art, and they would be exhibited together. And it was a triumph. It was just wonderful. But when I went to the exhibit to see this range of, you know, women's groups, mainly religious groups, I was stunned to discover that the only quilt in the exhibit that didn't have a name on it was the Latter-day Saint quilt. And she and I have had a little tug of war ever since. This beautiful object is now displayed in our stake center in a fabulous frame made especially for it. And I, you know, I'm a historian. I said, you, please, I want to put your name on this quilt and the names of anyone else who helped. And at one point, I thought I'd persuaded her. And then she just couldn't do it. It seemed too pushy, too proud, too trying to be out there. She really believes that in silent service, we serve God. Now, I respect her opinion, and I respect her, and we shouldn't live our lives to please historians, for heaven's sakes. But when I go home, I'm going to tell her about Mary Winch. Thank you.
Professor Ulrich would love to hear some of your questions, and we have a little way of doing this. We will be going one over there on that aisle, one over here with a microphone. Raise your hand. We will pass you the microphone. After you ask your question, you must give up your grip on the microphone. Okay, let me just repeat that. Okay, you must give up your grip on the microphone. Thank you. So if you have any questions, please raise your hand.
There's to be no debating here.
How would our esteemed historian suggest that we preserve our history and our writings when so much of them are on devices like this?
Mm-hmm. Well, we need to get the esteemed archivists, because this is a hot topic. All major libraries are working on this at great length. I know, I don't know about the Utah archives. Maybe somebody here can respond to that. But actually, it's a wonderful time of production of personal documents because of the internet. And I think they're probably doing it selectively in some kind of random way. But I know Harvard's deeply involved in this. The Schlesinger Library is following, and they've been following Zines and all kinds of things for years. But they have one person totally devoted to archiving blogs and websites and so on.
Thank you. I'm still thinking about the ratio of men's diarist to women's diarist, and I'm wondering about the old stereotype is that a woman is more inclined to speak of the personal, the emotive, etc., while a man would be more likely to be talking about the public. To that end, if you segregated out writings that are primarily about the public world and focused on that which was personal, I wonder what the ratio might be at that point. Any idea?
That's a terrific question, whether this is a consequence of a public-private divide. Significantly, the public-private divide is really a 19th century development, and in large measure, and theoretically, very much so, and in part a consequence in the United States of our political system. But I won't go into long detail about that. I will just respond that men's, from long experience working with both men's and women's diaries, it is true that women are far more likely to write about men than men are about women. I mean, there's the old idea, you know, wife gave birth, killed the cow. I mean, that's about what you get from a New Hampshire man's diary. And my argument is that any subordinate is going to give you a better picture of an organization than the person at the top, because they have to attend to all of these situations. So there is that. But actually, men's diaries can be surprisingly personal. And I love the quote from Wilford Woodruff where he told the missionaries, now, you write about the important things, write about who you baptize, et cetera, and don't write about what you had for dinner unless an angel comes or a raven and feeds it to you. Then you can write about it. But in fact, Wilford sometimes writes about what he has for dinner. And there's a lot of tourism, and some of the best evidence I have on women in England when he was on a mission comes from his diary and the diary from others. And he wasn't as obtuse as he was in Boston. He actually talked to some of these women and wrote down what they said. So it's a theory that's very powerful for, you know, public, private. But in practice, some of these men are amazingly sentimental. It's kind of interesting. It's a shared language that they're using. But they keep it because they're supposed to.
I Have you had any luck with social media finding the stuff that's not in archives? And if this, quote, stuff is anything like our house, we have more children's diaries than we have parents' diaries. What is the status of children's archiving?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. There are people who specialize in children's diaries. I just can't resist this story because it's so funny. I've been talking to the Schlesinger Library in the History of Women a little bit about maybe they'll get my papers. And I have some juvenilia in my paper. They'll take anything. But anyway, they said they got a phone call from an orthodontist wanting to know if they had any diaries from a certain period of time for children, you know, ages 10 to 16 or something. And so they went through their catalog and they said, yes, we've got 50. And he said, good, could somebody go through and see if any of them talk about braces? They said, you're welcome to come to the library and do that yourself. But, yeah, I think most archives would be thrilled to get children's diaries, and there are some that collect them, and there's a lot of scholarship on history of childhood. I have not gone out asking for diaries. I should. If anyone in this room knows where the original, not a typescript, not a copy, of Ella Shipp's diary is, or of Caroline Barnes Crosby, maybe somebody in this room knows where those two diaries are. They appear to be missing from the archive where they supposedly were last seen. So I just put it out here, and it's on the radio. So maybe I'll get an answer. Okay, thank you.
I have two questions. Is that all right?
Yeah, sure.
First question is, I had never heard the story of Zina's diary being found in a trunk by a great-great-granddaughter. Would you recall the name of that great-great-granddaughter?
It's in The Four Zinas. Okay. If you know that book, it's in the introduction.
Okay, thank you. Second question is, where is her diary now? Do you know?
The church archives.
It's in the archives.
Her diaries are... That's another thing. The diaries, the women's diaries, and maybe an archivist here can dispute this, but I've looked at all I could get my hands on, particularly from the, you know, before 1880. And they're often very fragile, kept in notebooks or especially in handmade documents. And Zina's are especially so. Lenora Taylor's is just heartbreaking, actually, to look at. Lots of pages cut out. Very faded ink. And so that tells me there were probably a lot more that didn't survive.
My mother kept a journal. And a lot of the time she would make comments that I don't think she was thinking about how other people would respond when she read them. But she really knew how to deliver a zinger every now and again. And I've thought a lot about that, about the response of my family after she died and we read her journal. And I've thought also about the fact I love stories. I love people's stories. And there are many things I haven't written down because I didn't want to violate confidentiality, especially because I have no control over what's read after I'm gone. How much, you know, women do tend to be story keepers and to have lots of confidences. How much of an effect do you think that has had upon women keeping journals, that they just don't want to violate someone else's privacy?
Yeah, I think that's true of any diarist. It's true of men as well. And there's so much secrecy in certain periods of church history that the men often use shorthand. as if no one could read it, you know. But or Wilfred Woodruff has his own little hieroglyphs and codes. People self-select. I mean, the secrets that people keep are really obvious. It's actually one of the interesting things about diaries is what isn't in there. But, boy, you'll make a historian happy if you spill it out there.
I was wondering, piggybacking on the last question, actually, I think sociologically and anthropologically, women tend to be the oral history keepers. Sometimes, you know, after you've been nursing babies all day and doing laundry, and paper and pencils are expensive if you're living in poverty, but I think that a lot of oral history was passed down in quilting bees and birthing sessions and things like that. And is there a way that we can capture some of these probably family folklore type things? But what's being done now to do those, the oral histories that are so many generations
right.
away now?
Right, that's a wonderful question. It's true of men and women. Storytelling. You know, I got most of my family history from my grandfather, who was a great storyteller, and my mother. I mean, so both men and women do it. Yes, in the book I wrote, The Age of Homespun, I used a lot of stories passed down about artifacts. And usually debunked them, actually. The stories, I mean, couldn't be trusted, and yet, you know, I say to my students, they're usually wrong, but they're true, because they tell you something about what people wanted to believe. And, you know, it's the game of telephone or whatever. Some oral traditions are powerful and important, but they have a methodology that you have to work with as well. The oral history opportunity is right now. People who are alive now. Actually, I've been talking about the 19th century. I feel somewhat guilty in a way because lots has been written about the 19th century. Not enough. But a lot has been written, but we haven't even started hardly on the 20th century. And a lot of historians are working on that. There are wonderful oral history projects. I'm thinking of the one that Claudia Bushman got going down at Claremont. I think other people, and the Red Center, of course, has been doing oral history again and again and again, Jesse Embry. And so... yeah, more. It's great collecting stories. So thanks for raising that very important point. There's somebody down here, I think. Oh, we're getting everybody. Okay, good. You're okay. Systematic. I can't see. Where are we now?
Right
up,
here.
Up. Okay. Okay. Oh, all right.
Well, I have a question I hope you can answer, but how are women going to realize the value of their own stories in their own lives if the only stories that we are taught in really society are about men?
Amen.
I mean, even if the men studied the women's stories.
It's outrageous.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
We have a question up here.
Hi. I'd just like your opinion. If someone was to say to you, I don't wish to keep a diary, I don't wish to record a journal because... I've experienced so much pain in my life, maybe through my family, that what I would write would be, you know, maybe bitter or sorrowful, and I don't wish to leave that for posterity. Would you advise keeping a journal in a case like that?
No.
What do you think of that?
No, people shouldn't be pushed. Although I will say, you know, my friend Judy Dishku is working on this wonderful project in Uganda. Nothing worse than being kidnapped as a little girl and raped and forced to be a child soldier. And if done well and carefully, telling the story can really be a healing thing. And that's one of the things that they're working with in that recovery project. But I'm not an expert on trauma, but I think there is a place for stories there and writing if handled well.
Two more?
I'm a personal historian, and we work with personal stories to record them. And we have a conference coming up in November. It's called Make Your Story Count. And I just want to really underscore everything you've said about the importance of holding on to those records and writing them down and their therapeutic value. But it isn't just enough to look for others. It's really, really important that we save the stories of our lives right now. And I really thank you for bringing to our attention the value of such small things as quilts and letters and autographs, because we have such things as quilts and diaries. And it's our history of this time that's so critical for us to hold on to. So I'm really glad that all these people are here, and I hope they take the message back in their hearts that their own personal history is every bit as much importance as anyone's that ever been written.
You're absolutely right. Thank you. Some of us prefer to read other people's mail.
As a fourth grade teacher, I talk with my students all the time about the importance of learning their cursive handwriting and handwriting things, because there is so much out there on the internet. How are archivists even being secure that this is something that was actually written by the person that it says it's being written? We talk about it and we debate about it because the kids don't want to learn their handwriting, and so I try and give them reasons. But inside my heart, I keep thinking, how are we don't have that plethora of written material anymore to go to, and as historians and archivists, I see a great big hole in what we can find to use for that primary material. Are they doing anything?
I'm going to be glib, because you've raised a terrific question, and just say, Google knows, right? I don't know. Any kind of source needs to be evaluated. I suspect there's going to be so much stuff from our generation, it's going to end up being quantitative patterns or something, a lot of it. Don't know. Good question. Get a speaker on technology.
Thank you very much. Professor Ulrich has also agreed to sign some books. So if you have bought a book and would like it signed, we'll be doing that up here. Otherwise, thank you very much. Please drive safely. And again, thank you so much for coming.